This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about probably the most significant battle of the Civil War, the most costly in terms of casualties of any battle in that war. And, of course, that war was the most costly in terms of casualties that the United States has ever taken part in. We'll be talking this morning with an historian who's provided a text to a new book that should certainly interest people who are interested in the Civil War or in military history or perhaps in American history. The book is The American Heritage: History of the Battle of Gettysburg. That's just recently been published. It's published by HarperCollins. In addition to having the text by our guest, Craig Simons, who is a professor of history at the U.S. Naval Academy, the book has many, many illustrations. It has maps. It has reproductions of paintings and drawings. It has photographs of what the battlefield looks like today, and it has many photographs from the time, portraits of people who fought there, photographs of the battlefield shortly afterwards, and it's quite an interesting book. So, again, if you're a Civil War enthusiast, or if you're just interested in American history, you might want to take a look at the book. It is definitely out in bookstores now. And as we talk this morning with Craig Simons, and if you have questions, you're invited to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILO, toll-free 800-222-WILO. Professor Simons, hello.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
No problem. My pleasure.
We appreciate it. We can talk maybe in some detail about the battle, not as much as there is in the book, obviously, but we can sketch out some of the particulars. But maybe just to ask a very basic question to start about the significance of the battle to the Civil War. I would guess that, in fact, there might be some people who would believe that, in fact, it was the last battle of the war, which it was not. But
correct,
it seemed to be the battle that was indeed the beginning of the end of the war.
Or at least the end of the beginning. I think there's a sentiment now that somehow the Civil War changed. It turned. Sometimes you see references to Gettysburg as the turning point in the war. And I think that becomes evident mostly in hindsight. As Americans, and particularly Southerners, look back on the Civil War, it seemed, perhaps in hindsight, that that was the moment when Confederate fortunes began to decline. I think it was less evident at the time. I think Southerners continued to hope, and not completely unrealistically, that they still had a chance, at least, to win this war and secure their independence. I think that chance was finally lost with the re-election of Abraham Lincoln in the fall of 1864. So the war had two more full years to run after Gettysburg, and in fact, in those 2 years, more Americans died after Gettysburg than before Gettysburg. And yet somehow our impression of the war is that on those first 3 days of July in 1863, the war reached a turning point. And I think as an historian looking back on that, it's easy now to say so, and in particular when you combine that with what was happening 1,000 miles to the west on the banks of the Mississippi River at Vicksburg, where on the 4th of July, the day after Pickett's charge, John Pemberton surrendered the city and his army to Ulysses S. Grant. So those twin blows, the loss, the defeat at Gettysburg, and the loss of Vicksburg, combined to depress Confederate fortunes. But it's only in hindsight that it becomes clear that that was, in fact, a decisive turning point in the war.
Mm-hmm. This battle was set up by a decision by Robert E. Lee,
yeah,
to move north. And apparently his hope was if he could achieve a decisive victory in the north, it would do a number of things, including perhaps turn opinion in the north against the war, toward negotiations, that it might indeed persuade people in the North that in rather than a military victory over the South, a deal would have to be made.
Yeah, I think that was a critical part of his decision. There are a couple of reasons why Lee wanted to invade the North. He had tried this earlier in the fall of 1862. After his victory at Second Manassas, he took his army across the Potomac River into Maryland and fought in the Battle of Antietam in September of 1862. For a variety of reasons, that had not worked out in the way that he had hoped. But in the spring of 1863, his army was stronger, larger, better equipped. Its morale was very high. It seemed to him this was the time to strike. And I think what he had in mind were two things. One, he wanted to take the war out of Virginia. He sided in the first place with the Confederacy because of his commitment to the state of Virginia. He loved Virginia. It pained him, I think, almost physically to see the war being fought on Virginia soil. Armies, even when they're being careful, despoil the ground on which they fight. So he would like to have seen a campaign season where the armies could move north across the Mason-Dixon line into Pennsylvania and let northern citizens feel the cost of this war, feel the pain of the war, that would play some role in convincing them that perhaps the South ought to be allowed to depart in peace. But as you suggest, in addition to that, I think he was looking for a victory, a decisive victory. He had won victories before, but none of them, all of them being fought in Virginia so far, except as we mentioned for Antietam, which did not work out for him, all of them and none of them came close to being the decisive kind of victory that would turn public opinion around. And if he could sustain his army in enemy territory for a campaign season and win a decisive victory north of the Mason-Dixon line, perhaps this would convince Northerners that the cost they would have to pay to keep the Confederacy in the Union was more than they were willing to pay, and that they might consider opening negotiations. That was his great hope. Mm.
And he was coming off a victory at Chancellorsville.
Indeed. Yeah, Chancellorsville, almost exactly 2 months before, in the first few days of May, he had won a spectacular and, I have to say, improbable victory. At that time, he had detached a third of his army under James Longstreet off to an expedition to Suffolk in Virginia, and therefore only had between 55 and 60,000 men, and was attacked by a Union army that numbered close to 130,000 men. So he faced odds of 2-1. And yet, during the Gettysburg campaign, his odds would be a lot better. So he seemed to have reason for confidence.
Was there some particular reason that the battle took place where it did, that is, at Gettysburg? Something about it, or was it, in some sense, a matter of chance that that's where it happened?
Well, mostly chance. Neither army commander looked at the map and said, Gettysburg, that's the place I want to take. Hmm. Gettysburg was a relatively sleepy little town, a population of 2,400. It was the county seat of Adams County, still is, in fact, the county seat of Adams County in Pennsylvania, and had no particular strategic significance except one. And that was that if you look at a road map, not so much now, but certainly then, of south-central Pennsylvania, the road network kind of gravitates toward Gettysburg. The roads that radiate out from the town square at Gettysburg head for north, south, east, and west. There are actually 10 of them altogether, almost like the spokes of a wheel, radiate outward from Gettysburg, so that a general who said, I need to bring the disparate elements of my forces together in a convenient location, looking at a map, would see naturally that Gettysburg would be the magnet that would draw them there. And in fact, it turned out to draw both armies there.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Craig Simons. He's professor of history at the United States Naval Academy, and he is the author of half a dozen books on the Civil War. And he's provided the text for the new American Heritage History of the Battle of Gettysburg. It's published by HarperCollins. It's out now and has a wealth of photographs and illustrations and reproductions of paintings and drawings from the time. So if you're interested in the Civil War, you might want to look at it. And your questions are welcome. I have one person here holding and ready to go. Others are invited. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And the caller is in Chicago. And line number 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Good morning.
I was wondering, is it true that the Battle of Gettysburg might not have taken place if Jeb Stuart had been where he was supposed to be instead of out on a raid? He's supposed to be the eyes of Lee's army, and he was not there, and so Lee sort of blundered into this battle. And when Stuart did show up, I understand that General Lee gave him a rather stern talking to. Is that true?
Right. Yes, it's mostly true. I'm not sure whether the battle wouldn't have been fought, but it might certainly have come out fought differently or in a different sequence. It is true. The cavalry in the 19th century was the intelligence-gathering arm of the army. The cavalry, his principal job was not to draw saber and conduct these dramatic mounted charges at one another. They did some of that, certainly, but their primary function was to gather information about where the enemy army was, where it was going, how numerous it was, and to screen the enemy's cavalry from obtaining precisely that same kind of information about your own army's movement. So they operated on the fringes and the parameters of the armies to both gather intelligence and prevent the enemy from doing the same.
Well, you know, I read a book called War Years of Jeb Stuart. W.W. Blackburn wrote that.
Yeah.
He has always defended Stuart's actions as far as the Battle of Gettysburg is concerned, but there are people who will claim.
Well, I think by and large he deserves a defense. I think what happened after the battle was over and the Confederacy began to recognize it for the dramatic turning point it became subsequently, they tried to find an explanation for their disappointment. And they found three possible culprits. One was Jeb Stuart, and I'll talk more about that in just a minute here. Another was Richard Stoddart Ewell, who had replaced Stonewall Jackson in command of the Second Corps, who hesitated at the end of the first day, where many critics claim Stonewall Jackson would not have hesitated.
Well, he had the army on the run, didn't he?
He did indeed.
Yeah, he had the Union army on the run after that first day.
And the third culprit, often identified, is James Longstreet, who, critics claim, behaved more conservatively, more slowly than he ought to have done, given the circumstances. But as for Jeb Stuart, let me talk about him first. Jeb Stuart, I think, did actually a remarkable job as a cavalry commander during the Confederate Army's maneuver northward through the Shenandoah and then the Cumberland Valleys. He effectively screened his Confederate Army from the prying eyes of the enemy. And if it's true that to a certain extent Lee blundered into the battle at Gettysburg, it is also true that so did the Union Army. What makes this battle so interesting is these two armies are gravitating toward each other, almost like two men in a darkened room with their hands outstretched. And finally, they make contact at their fingertips, not really sure what's behind that, and almost as if they were wearing blindfolds, begin slugging at one another. This was not a battle planned by either side. It was a battle that each side had to react to as it unfolded in front of them, and the cavalry on both sides, I suppose, shares some responsibility for that.
Well, now, this thing about Pickett's charge, there's always been a controversy about Pickett's charge.
Yeah.
Was that a wise decision, or in retrospect, was that rather foolish?
Well, the great thing about being an historian is that in retrospect, we know all sorts of things that are less clear at the time. Clearly, in retrospect, the attack that has gone down in history is Pickett's charge. You know, Pickett was one of only three divisions that took place in this attack, but he had the Virginia lobby behind him and therefore got better press. It probably shouldn't be called the Pickett-Pettigrew-Trimble charge or Longstreet's charge, But we'll stick with Pickett's charge for now, and clearly, because it failed, it's obvious that it was not a good idea.
Well, you know,
let me finish here. If you construct a case for Lee's decision to send that attack, you can put together a pretty good case that it had a reasonable chance. As it turned out, we know that it didn't. But the decision was not quite so desperate as perhaps some people considered it afterward.
Well, you know, that charge has always gotten a lot of publicity. But isn't it a fact that a few months, I'd say 18 months later at Franklin, that charge was actually more dramatic, was it not?
Absolutely. I am also the biographer of Patrick Claiborne, and my biography of him, Stonewall of the West, deals quite a bit with the charge at Franklin. This was a charge by almost exactly twice as many men over a field almost exactly twice as long against troops that were not only well-positioned but entrenched. So far more desperate a decision on the part of John Bell Hood.
Well, the tragedy about that was they had a chance to destroy that Northern Army in Tennessee, and Hood blew it.
I think that's probably an accurate assessment.
They had a chance to destroy that army after Chickamauga and Hood. Well, of course, Bragg was in charge then, but I'm saying that. Later on, Hood had a chance to destroy that army, and he blew his opportunity.
I think that's probably. I mean, we could have a whole discussion about that one too. But
okay, I'm not going to
be right.
I know you have a lot of calls, so thank you very much.
All right, well,
you're
thanks
very welcome
for the call, and of course, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Again, our guest is Craig Simons. He's a professor of history at the U.S. Naval Academy and has written several books about the Civil War and has provided the text for this book I've mentioned here, The New American Heritage History of the Battle of Gettysburg. Looking at this book, I think in my mind reinforces something that one has to appreciate about the way conditions under which war at this time were fought. One being that it was extremely difficult, maybe next to impossible, for the commanders to have a complete picture of the battlefield and what was going on. That would be one thing. And the other thing would be the level of autonomy that battlefield commanders had, and the fact that sometimes either if one was hesitant about doing what you were ordered to do, or if one actually took the initiative and did something other than you were ordered, that could be the turning point one way or the other.
Certainly true. I mean, we mentioned intelligence gathering. Obviously, battlefield communications were very different in the 19th century than they are today. Often what would happen is a commanding general would turn to a staff aide and say, please present my compliments to General Ewell and ask him if he believes he has a good chance to take that hill, that he should do so if practicable. And the aide would salute smartly, gallop off across the field, spend perhaps 10 minutes getting to the place, finding the person, repeating the orders. And, of course, if you've ever played that game where you sit around a campfire and whisper something in one another's ear until it makes all the way around the circle, how dramatically messages can change in the transmission. The other way was to jot down orders on a piece of paper and hand them to a courier who would gallop off. These create imperfect battlefield conditions for decision makers. And it also creates circumstances where, as you mentioned, junior officers, subordinate officers, without orders or with orders that are unclear, often had to make decisions on their own. The consequences of which could change the outcome of a battle. One of the fascinating things about the Civil War in general, and about Gettysburg in particular, is that there are numerous cases where relatively junior officers, down to the level of regimental commanders, who were no more than young men in their middle 20s, had to make decisions about how to behave under certain circumstances without the benefit of oversight from the high command. And so in the end, it's a wide variety of individuals who I tried to talk about in this book, other than just the Army commanders, who made decisions that determined the outcome of the battle at Gettysburg. Hmm.
I wonder, too, if there are ways in which, here's, what I'm thinking about, the fact that, let us say, between the end of the Civil War and World War One, warfare changed tremendously. You know, World War One was something that people who had fought in previous wars, it was something entirely different. But I guess I also wonder in what sense the Civil War differs from, for example, if I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but say we compare Gettysburg to Waterloo. That's not a very long period of time. It's only about 50 years, I guess.
No, but it's a wonderful comparison to make, and you've raised a very interesting point, and that is that one of the things that makes the Civil War fascinating is that it sits exactly on an historical pivot point that marked a dramatic transition in the nature of warfare. A lot of people overlook the fact that only 5 years before the Civil War began, a Frenchman had invented something called a mini-ball, which allowed soldiers in the ranks to fire a bullet out of a rifled musket. Now, prior to this, they'd always used smoothbore muskets, which were accurate up to about 80 yards, perhaps 100 yards if you were a really good shot and had no wind. But with a mini-ball fired from a rifled musket, you could now fire 1,000 yards, so 10 times the distance. What that meant was that the casualties are going to be horrible. And the Civil War marks the transition between Napoleonic warfare, the first big war, to use mass armies, armies numbering in six figures and larger, and the Industrial Revolution. Remember, the Civil War is the first war, not only with the rifled musket and the mini-ball, but it's the first war with armored warships, railroads, telegraphs, even aerial balloons. It's the first war in which a submarine sank an enemy warship. The Civil War sits right on that pivot point of the transition from Napoleonic warfare to World War I. And in fact, if you look at the Civil War in 1861, it looks like Napoleonic warfare. If you look at the Civil War in 1865, it looks like World War I. And Gettysburg sits right in the middle of that pivot point. The troops were unentrenched, facing each other across an open field, using all the modern weapons of warfare, and slaughtering each other in unprecedented numbers. And I think because the Civil War occupied that historical transition moment, that it was not only the greatest national trauma in our nation's history, but also a turning point in the history of warfare generally.
And the casualties at Gettysburg, something like 50,000?
The number that most historians have settled on, the records are imperfect in those days, but the casualty figures you'll hear range between 53,000 and 58,000. The reason we can't be certain, as I mentioned, is because of the record keeping. But I also want to mention that this does not mean killed. 55,000, we'll choose a middle number there, includes the total number killed, mortally wounded, wounded, captured, and missing. And, of course, there's a large number missing, which may be missing presumed dead or missing presumed runaway or some combination of the two. But yes, it's the single bloodiest military engagement in our national history, including and eclipsing things like Iwo Jima, Okinawa, D-Day, Battle of the Bulge, in terms of a 3-day period. If you measure the Battle of the Bulge over its entire 6 weeks, era, you might get a different number. Mm.
Let's talk with some other people here. Terre Haute, Indiana, next, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got in a little bit late, so you may already have answered this question. If so, I apologize. Would you give us an analysis of what you thought of the film Gettysburg?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The film Gettysburg is based on a wonderful novel by a man named Michael Shara, the late Michael Shara, S-H-A-A-R-A, with a curious title of The Killer Angels. In fact, when Ted Turner first bought the rights to the book and planned to make a film out of it, he had planned to call it The Killer Angels, but he ran the name against a test audience, and they assumed it would be a biker movie. So he changed the name to Gettysburg. But what makes The Killer Angels such a wonderful book is that all the events that take place are historically accurate. What makes it a work of fiction, and it won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in the 1970s, what makes it a work of fiction is that Shara speculates about what the individuals on the battlefield may have been thinking. And, of course, although his speculations are reasonable, we can't know as historians whether they're accurate or not. So it ends up being a work of fiction. Ted Turner and Ron Maxwell, the director, did a wonderful job of bringing that to the film. And the film itself is quite faithful to the development of the book. And I think the book is better, I think the film is very good. They took great care to make sure that they had the little things right. And I think it's an excellent portrayal. And it focuses on particular individuals. It makes some interpretations that I personally don't agree with, but they're perfectly reasonable interpretations. It makes Robert E. Lee a man who already sees death in his future. I'm not sure that was true. It makes James Longstreet a bit more prescient about the future than I think he was in reality. And, of course, it focuses a great deal on Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, the commander of the 20th Maine Regiment, which is one of those examples that I mentioned earlier of a relatively junior officers having to make responsible decisions in moments of crisis with the broadest consequences. I think it's nice that he focused on Chamberlain. I tell my students, obviously this demonstrates that college professors are wonderful military leaders, but he could have chosen any one of at least a dozen other regimental commanders who occupy positions equally important and had to make decisions with equal consequences. But the short answer to your questions is I think it's a wonderful film.
Hmm. It's one of the things that you note in the book, there's a little section where you write about Longstreet and that Lee, he divided his army into these three corps and had his three top commanders were Generals Longstreet, Ewell, and Hill. And also you talked about the fact that after the battle, when people in the South started asking this question, well, whose fault was it that we lost, a number of different people and ended up being targets of blame. Longstreet, one, Ewell, another. I suppose there's some people who even wanted to blame, would go as far as blaming Robert E. Lee, although that's, you know, his image was so highly polished that that doing that was, you know, likely to get you into trouble. Although Longstreet himself apparently, in his talking about the battle afterwards, said that he thought basically that it was really that the loss was Lee's responsibility.
Well, and that was mostly his undoing, of course. Uh-huh. In the years after the Civil War, when the South was licking its wounds and trying to explain to itself what had gone wrong, they constructed a sort of an alternate past called the Lost Cause. And in the Lost Cause, all the women were beautiful, all the men were handsome and brave. It's sort of the kind of image you get out of Gone with the Wind. And it dominated American historiography for a long time. And in this vision of the past, Robert E. Lee was the noble warrior. No one would be critical of Robert E. Lee. And yet Longstreet was. And by doing so, in his own memoirs, by writing in his memoirs that Lee was, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase that he used, that he kept pushing his men at the enemy until enough blood was shed to satisfy his bloodlust, or words to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
A shocking words to the South, and convinced them that Longstreet was an apostate, that he was, in fact, he ended up being nearly as hated in the post-Civil War South as William T. Sherman, for example. Among his other sins, of course, was that Longstreet sided with the Republican Party during Reconstruction. He became, in the parlance of the day, a scallywag. So that pretty much undercut Longstreet's reputation, and his historical view was quite low until it was largely resuscitated by Michael Shara in The Killer Angels and by Ted Turner in the movie Gettysburg, where he becomes a person carrying a very difficult psychological burden. He's ordered to execute an attack he does not believe in, and this puts him in a very difficult psychological position, and it creates a great dramatic circumstances for both the book and the movie. But yes, Longstreet was one of the three of the individuals that Southerners tried to blame rather than Robert E. Lee for an explanation as to why the South lost the Battle of Gettysburg. One we've already talked about, and that's Stuart, whether he did or did not provide Lee with the kind of intelligence about the enemy's movements and strength that Lee needed to make decisions. Another was Longstreet, who perhaps was slower than he ought to have been. And the third one was Richard Stoddart Ewell, who hesitated at perhaps just the wrong moment.
Well, can you defend, I think earlier you said that you could, and maybe I'm misremembering this, but can you defend Lee's decision ultimately to hurl his troops against the northern troops that were heavily dug in, and that they were just slaughtered? They just went into it just a hail of lead, and that was that.
Well, Pickett's charge has gone down in history as kind of the quintessential example of throwing your forces at troops in a good defensive position. Mm-hmm. As one of the earlier callers pointed out, it's not the only example of this in the Civil War by a long shot, but it's the one that we've kind of accepted as a mythic touchstone for this sort of tactics. And clearly, in hindsight, it's obvious that this was a desperate and wrongheaded decision by Robert E. Lee. But I'll try to construct an argument for it before it's taken place. And that is that Lee had won the battle the first day. When the armies first collided head-on, north and west of Gettysburg on the 1st of July, the Confederates won that attack. They had momentum, they had numbers, they had position. They threw the Federals not only out of their defensive positions, drove them all the way through town and back onto Cemetery Hill. The next day, when Lee ordered Longstreet to attack the Union left flank, Longstreet delayed before executing that attack, but when it took place, it too was successful. It drove the Federals out of Devil's Den and the wheat field and the peach orchard, inflicted terrible casualties, more casualties on the Federals than the Confederates received themselves, nearly broke through. And Lee could see that night as he thought about it, I nearly won the battle the first day, I nearly won the battle the second day. If only I could coordinate these attacks in a place directly under my own vision, there, directly across the field, in the shade of that little clump of trees, where only 5,000 Federals, you mentioned that they were dug in, but recall that this is an open field meeting. There are no entrenchments on this battlefield except on Culp's Hill. But there in the center, those troops were simply standing on a gentle fold of Pennsylvania countryside. They were not entrenched. There were nothing to protect them except a low stone wall about 18 inches high, which if you were going to worry about being shot in the ankle, I guess would be useful, but otherwise not. And he had numbers. Lee could put 15,000 men against 5,000, an advantage of 3-1. He could cover their advance with a massed artillery barrage. And the smoke from that artillery barrage, as well as the shells that would keep the enemy pinned down, would cover the troops as they crossed the field. This is the way he envisioned it. And if they broke through at that weak spot in the Federal line, the two flanks of the Federal army could not stand alone. The army would have to give up its position and fall back and be cut up as it moved. This might yet give him the victory that he sought. Now we know that that vision was false, that it did not happen, that in fact the Confederate artillery barrage did not silence the Federal guns, which opened up as soon as the infantry came into the open field, and what emerged was very nearly a slaughter. But I think you could see beforehand how the vision did not seem quite so desperate as it does now in hindsight. There is a great quotation, by the way, from Faulkner out of, I believe it's Intruder in the Dust, where he says, for every Southern boy, at some moment in his life, it's not yet 3 o'clock in the afternoon on that early July day, and the flags hang limply at the staffs, and it hasn't happened yet, and it could all be called back, but it's going to happen. We know it's going to happen. So that our ability to look back and know the results, know the outcome of that, leads us to suggest how desperate this attack was. But beforehand, it's not completely unreasonable. Did I convince you?
I'll have to think about it some more. Let's talk with some other callers. So we'll go to Paxton is next, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
I have two questions for you. Number one is, at Gettysburg, all the reading I've done, Gordon Meade gets short shrift, so I'd like you to speak to his importance, relative importance,
okay,
in that battle. And the second question is, I'm trained as an economist, and I always see Vicksburg as fundamentally more important than Gettysburg, even though Gettysburg has a psychological swing, because Vicksburg really affects the logistics of the war more.
Right. Yeah, let me take those in turns. George Gordon Meade first. Meade is a largely overlooked Civil War figure. He doesn't somehow fit into the pantheon of our top-drawer heroes. He's not Grant or Sherman or Lee or Jackson. And yet Meade happens, by chance mostly, to find himself at the epicenter of the war here at Gettysburg. It came about in a curious sort of way. The army was still under the command of Joseph Hooker. When this campaign began, when Lee's army started north, Hooker was still in command of the Army of the Potomac and was relieved from that position after quarreling with Lincoln over a relatively minor issue only 3 days before the battle began. So Meade finds himself in command of this army, fighting the battle of its life, only 3 days after assuming command. And his command position as a major general is that virtually the same as that of his corps commanders and his division commanders, all of whom are major generals. And having been in command for so short a period, in an army that had already experienced a kind of rotating door of command responsibility, led him to have almost to require him to solicit the views of his subordinates before making decisions. And at Gettysburg, the decisions he had to make were relatively minor. Shall we stay or shall we run? He decided in each case to stay and fight it out. They turned out to be the right answers. Lincoln, after the battle, was a little disappointed that Meade did not pursue as effectively as he might have Lee's defeated army as it retreated south. Lincoln was hoping that Lee, having suffered such a terrible reverse, that this might be an opportunity to crush his army now, perhaps to shorten the war by as much as a year. But even if it shortened the war by only a month, Lincoln felt it was worth taking risks, and yet Meade did not take those risks. Lee was managed to escape back across the Potomac River into Virginia. Now, Meade remained in command of the Army of the Potomac, but Grant was brought to the Eastern Theater after his success at Vicksburg to become overall commander and traveled with Meade's army. So for the rest of that war, most people referred to that army as Grant's army, even though Meade technically remained in command. So Meade is, you're right, often the overlooked soldier of the Civil War. He made few mistakes, but on the other hand, neither did he achieve any dramatic successes. Now, as to your second question about Vicksburg, I think you're absolutely right. If you look at it in strategic terms, if you're studying these campaigns in a war college, you would say the capture of Vicksburg and the opening of the Mississippi River with its tremendous economic and logistical implications is clearly a more important strategic success for the North than defeating Lee's army at Gettysburg. And yet, having taken place in Gettysburg, where the northern press in the Eastern Theater paid more attention to what was happening to the two main armies in the Eastern Theater, and because it did mark, subsequently, the sort of high point of Confederate hopes, Gettysburg had a greater psychological impact on the voting electorate and on international public opinion than did the campaign at Gettysburg. So that I think, yes, Vicksburg is the greater strategic victory, but Gettysburg is the more important psychological victory for the North, and in terms of its implications for foreign recognition and so forth, was excruciatingly important to the Lincoln administration.
Okay. Could I follow up with one more?
Certainly.
With General Meade, he obviously behaved conservatively, but he was the first commander to win a battle over Lee. Now, was his genius to not overreach? Was his genius to keep the Potomac Army together and then also to deal with Grant?
Yeah, I think particularly the second of those. I mean, it's hard to say after the fact that he ought to have done this or ought to have done that. A lot of enthusiasts about the Civil War like to engage in counterfactual hypothesizing and begin the sentence, well, if this, then what? And we can never know the answer to those. But I think you're absolutely right in his ability to cooperate with Grant. Grant came east fully intending to replace Meade in command of the Army of the Potomac. He was going to put one of his favorite subordinates that he got along with in command of that army. And he went out to meet Meade and talk to him, and over several days, to Grant's credit, came to decide that Meade was exactly the man he wanted. He was conscientious. He was responsible. He would take orders. He knew what he was about. He was a professional. And he remained exactly that through the war. And though he and Grant occasionally quarreled, not very often, Meade made it possible to translate Grant's overall strategic vision into the movements of the Army of the Potomac and presided over the movements of the Army all the way to Appomattox. So Meade certainly shares with Grant some of the responsibility and the credit for the final outcome of that campaign. I think you're right.
Thank you.
All
You're
right.
Welcome.
Let's go to line two. This is Charleston. Hello.
Yes, I had a question concerning
the Wilderness Campaign and also the Georgia Campaign. As I understand from a book called The Civil War, a day-by-day account, edited by John S. Bowman, there was just as many casualties, probably more killed in each of those separate campaigns than has occurred in Gettysburg. So I was wondering if you could respond to that. And then also,
sure.
I'm kind of a novice to this still, even though I've been to Gettysburg and read several books. But I hope I have my generals right. In the Wilderness Campaign, wasn't that Grant versus Lee, and Lee was deeply entrenched, and a number of the soldiers were left on the field to die, and Grant would not ask for a truce. Could you respond to that, please?
Yeah, I will. First of all, in terms of the casualties, the Wilderness Campaign, as it's usually known, began on the 1st of May, 1864, and lasted through pretty much the end of July. It lasted all spring and well into the summer, because what historians do is they lump together several battles, the Battle of the Wilderness, the Battle of Spotsylvania, the Battle of Cold Harbor, and so forth, into which is actually a series of battles. It took place over a 40-day period from the Rapidan River all the way down to the gates to Richmond. Any one of those battles, the Battle of the Wilderness, for example, or the Battle of Spotsylvania, does not come up to the casualty levels at Gettysburg. But if you count them all as one continuous campaign over a 5 or 6 week period, and you add all those casualties together, then yes, they surpass the number of casualties in the Gettysburg campaign. As for the Atlanta campaign, which began at exactly the same time, May 1864 through July of 1864, when Sherman worked his way southward toward Atlanta, finally capturing the city in September, even if you add all of those casualties together, they still don't come up to the number of casualties suffered in the one battle, 3 days, at Gettysburg. But casualties were horrendous in the Civil War. There's no getting around it. More Americans were killed, and I'm not talking casualties now, I'm talking killed, in the American Civil War than in all other American wars combined. I think we finally passed the number sometime in the last couple of months of the Vietnam War. But that includes World War I and World War II. Twice as many Americans in the Civil War as in World War II, for example, in spite of the horrible casualties of that conflict. So, yes, I'll grant you the point that the casualties were horrible throughout this war, but there was never a concentration of death in a single battle such as it took place at Gettysburg in July of 1863. And, yes, the Wilderness Campaign did pit Grant, although technically, as we just mentioned, it was Meade's army with Grant in attendance, Grant against Lee. The story about Grant's unwillingness to give a truce was not in the Wilderness Battle. It was at the Battle of Cold Harbor. Cold Harbor. And it was Lee who was unwilling to grant that truce until Grant admitted that he had lost. This was kind of a 19th century thing. You know, you admit that you lost, that you're asking for a truce, and then I'll grant it. But until you say, you know, yeah, you won, then I won't grant a truce. And so, and because of that peculiar 19th century attitude, soldiers probably bled to death on the battlefield.
I have a follow-up question.
Sure.
If I may, it has to do with Walt Whitman's, the poet and journalist at the time, and since now we're talking about 8 journalists who have died in our ongoing war in Afghanistan, what was the dilemma or the situation of the journalist during that period of time, during the Civil War?
Well, we were still trying to work it out. Because the Civil War was such a transitional period in American history and in the nature of warfare generally, some of the rules of war were not very clear. For a long time, journalists just came down whenever they felt like it and talked to whoever they wanted, and that was that. The first general to say, no, I'm going to put some rules on this and we're going to get a hold of this situation was Sherman. William T. Sherman hated the press, hated reporters. He would have shot him if he could have gotten away with it. And he banned them from his army and banned them from his camp. That was in 1864. That's after Gettysburg. At the time of Gettysburg, there were still reporters traveling with the armies and sketch artists who traveled with the armies. Alfred Wad, several of whose drawings appear in the book that I've written, was an eyewitness to many of the scenes that he drew. Cameramen, photographers, did not show up until 15 days after the battle. Camera photography in those days was a very dicey undertaking, more of an art than a science, and required the movement of all sorts of equipment in a wagon, and of course you could only take still shots because this film had to be exposed for a certain number of seconds. So the only photographs we have of Gettysburg are of the battlefield 2 weeks afterward. But we do have the sketch artists from Alfred Waad, and we have eyewitness accounts from a number of reporters. And, of course, the soldiers themselves wrote eyewitness accounts for their hometown papers and sent them back. And some of those 19th-century volunteer soldiers were surprisingly literate and wrote quite moving accounts of the battle, and, again, some of which I've included in the book.
Thank you very much.
All
You're
right,
welcome.
Let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for writing about this. I think it is an important war for Americans because we, due to our geographic isolation, have never been in major wars, and
right.
We're very fortunate for that. I think Gettysburg is crucial because I personally have always questioned why. I mean, our nation obviously had some issues, you know, besides slavery. I mean, there were some major, major issues between the North and South, but why did the war drag on? You know, this question has always bothered me because this is Americans shooting up Americans, which,
yeah.
You know, we're a pacifist nation by history, and, you know, it's just an amazing thing. And I think it comes down to Gettysburg, and I'm not sure I'm right on this, but how far is Gettysburg from Washington?
Well, Gettysburg is about almost exactly a two-hour drive. It's about 80 miles. It's fairly close.
So
almost close enough to hear the sound of the gunfire, but not quite.
So 4 days' march, in other words.
Probably.
You know.
If you're Stonewall Jackson, it's a four-day march. With a regular army moving maybe 10 to 15 miles a day, it might be a five-day, six-day march.
Well, or if you're Rangers, of course, you can go a whole lot farther.
Yeah.
But
it was perceived at the time, accurately, I think, as a genuine threat. I think Washington was less the target of Lee's initial campaign than Baltimore and Philadelphia. Both of those cities went into a near panic, erected barricades in the streets, called out the local militia. I mean, they started digging trenches outside Philadelphia, fully expecting Lee's army to show up at any minute.
Well,
I might take issue, by the way, with your assumption that America is a pacifist nation. I do agree that we've been fortunate as a nation to have friendly neighbors, Canada and Mexico. We did fight a war with Mexico in the 1840s, but it was at our initiation. We've never really been seriously threatened in our security by either of those nations, and I hope that remains true. And so when in our foreign wars we were able, in both of the two big world wars, of course, to stay out of it for at least a while before getting in, and those are all blessings to this society. But you ask why the war went on so long. I mentioned earlier that Gettysburg is a turning point, particularly in our ability to look back on it and understand what was to come. But I think the reason the war went on after the July of 1863 and the disappointments at Vicksburg and Gettysburg is the South still expected to win.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, their morale was not as high as it had been. And I don't think their expectation was necessarily misplaced. They were outnumbered. They had less resources. All that's true. But on the other hand, what they had to do to achieve was convince the Northern voters that it would not be worth paying the price of continuing this war, and it would be better, cheaper, to let the South go.
Well,
and I think they believed that was possible right up until Lincoln was reelected. After that, I think they're fighting mostly for each other and from momentum and from inertia and from an inability to perceive a realistic alternative.
Well, because I think Gettysburg, I mean, and I don't know that this is true, but there was a common impression, at least from friends I've had who studied the war, that the South would actually have better soldiers and a better army. But I think it's whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I think it's because they did come so close to taking, at least, you know, a major battle that could have brought, you know, certainly a ceasefire, if not an outright truce. I've always wondered where this momentum comes from. I think the Union was very scared because the, you know, Confederate states, you know, are about to break the Keystone State, which is pretty frightening, you know, and the South came away with the impression that, wow, we can win this war.
If you're looking for a reason as to why there isn't an earlier settlement, I mean, a settlement based on what terms? This is, remember, after the announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
And as you correctly noted, there were differences between the North and South other than slavery, but slavery was the one unsolvable problem. There's no compromise on slavery. You can't be sort of a slave. You can't have some slaves. Compromise, there's just no middle ground on that issue. It's why the two sides eventually went to war. And having announced the Emancipation Proclamation and being very clear that he would not back away from that position, the South said, we either have to win this war or we are going to be subjected to a society where our property is emancipated. And that was a prospect they simply could not abide. The North was in the same situation. Having committed themselves to the notion of emancipation, there was no backing down from the statement. So after January 1st, 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect, a compromise settlement between the two sides, if it was ever possible, about which I'm kind of skeptical anyway, became impossible. And I think that's another reason why the two sides fought. Let me just make a quick comment, if I can, about Southern prowess on the battlefield. If you want to use a football analogy, I guess you'd say the South beat the spread. You know, they did better than the numbers suggest they ought to have been able to do. In terms of white males of military age, they suffered a 4-to-1 disadvantage in population, and they had even greater disadvantage in terms of this being the first industrial war, the capability to produce the kinds of things that would maintain an industrially based war. So given those disadvantages, the fact that they fought so well for so long suggests that they did extremely well on the battlefield. But on the other hand, it's a very difficult thing for the North to march into the South and occupy and take that land away from them. The South's job was an easier one. They had to defend what they already had. I think the soldiers on both sides were absolutely remarkable in their willingness to sacrifice, in their willingness to stay and fight even when their enlistments expired. They would renew those enlistments. The kind of losses such as we saw at Gettysburg, where a third of those who were there became a casualty. We talk about an army being decimated. That means 10%. At Gettysburg, 33% were taken away from the armies, killed, wounded, or missing. And I think to call upon soldiers to make that kind of sacrifice month after month for a four-year period, I give kudos to the soldiers of both sides.
We're going to have to stop, and there's certainly much, much more we could talk about, but we simply use the time. Professor Simons, we want to say to you thanks very much. For
my pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest, Craig Simons, he's professor of history at the U.S. Naval Academy and has his home in Annapolis, Maryland. And if you're interested in reading this book that we have talked about, it is The New American Heritage History of the Battle of Gettysburg. It's published by HarperCollins.